paper 3, section 5, which is old single column page 50. Okay, so pretty fun section to top the year off here. A section that a fair number of people, I believe, are familiar with. The inevitabilities, yes, we get to do the inevitabilities tonight. So, and notice that, we have a bit of a transition happening here. Going to start to focus in on details a little bit more. When you're talking about the attributes of God, remember the title of this paper and the whole idea of starting with the nature of God and then asking the question, well, deductively, what does that imply in terms of attributes? Well, you're really starting to go down the deductive chain a ways when you start talking about not eternal rule, infinite rule, or whatever, but supreme rule. And, just even though it's not really, brought up in this section, remember that the basic way to appreciate how that direct downstep occurs from the Father's point of view, rather than our point of view, universal Father downstepped to the supreme level as the supreme being. And then the supreme being inserts his nature and influence into time, and it all comes down in a hierarchy from there. So that you can think of it very directly, that the Father's rule is coming down through the supreme being. So I think let's just jump right in. The key thing we'll want to do is when we go through the abilities, is pause on each one and reflect a little bit. Let's see what it's always interesting to notice what else is in this section besides the inevitabilities. There's a tendency to sort of skip the rest of the section and just focus on the inevitabilities. There's a lot of very significant things in this section besides the inevitabilities. So go ahead. All right.
Paper 3, The Attributes of God, Section 5, The Father's Supreme Rule. In his contact with the post-Havona creations, the Universal Father does not exercise his infinite power and final authority by direct transmittal, but rather through his sons and their subordinate personalities. And God does all this of his own free will. Any and all power is delegated, if occasion should arise, if it should become the choice of the divine mind, could be exercised direct. But as a rule, such action only takes place as a result of the failure of the delegated personality to fulfill the divine trust. At such times and in the face of such default and within the limits of the reservation of divine power and potential, the Father does act independently and in accordance with the mandates of his own choice. And that choice is always one of unfailing perfection and infinite wisdom.
Just one little thing to note there. It's neat that they emphasize that it's a divine trust, that some delegated personality has failed to fulfill. It's a divine trust, but it's not a divine personality who's been delegated that divine trust. There's a measure of that goes down below what we're immediately talking about here with the planetary princes. It comes all the way down to ourselves. There's a measure of divine trust that's put into our hands as well. And so the challenge of somehow finding the internal integrity to live up to such a delegated trust is pretty amazing to think about, and what the, kind of a challenge, you know, and what kind of trust the Father has to give you such a trust. Just to not let it get too well. What does this really have to do with me immediately? You know, there's always something that's between the lines that you know is touching on you too. You know, we all know the hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny. That's a good simple example of you know divine trust that can easily be dropped unless you assume the responsibility to take it up.
Yep. Isn't it said somewhere where they're talking about the Lanananda and Varanda deck that that's the line at which cosmic default occurs below that versus right. above that?
Right. That's the coinage of the name Lan on an deck. That literally means no longer one like expression.
So,
you know, so you've dropped, you know, you're starting at unity, you know, full absolute unity, and you're downstepping towards individuality, and there has to be some critical line that you cross where the innate unity is no longer up to the challenges that might confront that individual, you know, to keep that unity in mind, and so things can break. Yeah, and then that's, it's kind of interesting. I mean, that'll come up a little bit here. You might think Melchizedek, Varandadek, Lananadek in a very linear way, but it's not really that linear. In many ways, Varandadeks are higher than creator sons. Yeah, remember, they're the most high fathers, and they are occasionally. Activated as direct expressions of the Father's unquestionable sovereignty. So it's not like it's a fading line. It's very solidly integrous at the Varanda decks. And then, and you see that if you just look at the papers, you've got, you have Melchizedek and you have Varanda decks. And then you go to the section on Lananadex, and there's 600 million different flavors of them, and all this. At that point, you definitely go into a very individuated expression where you're going to try to match up with all kinds of different flavors. And
but even above that line, Varandadex is not going to be given the task of doing what a divine counselor does. I mean, who's there is in their.
Right.
Their niche.
Right, yeah. So that's what I'm saying. In many ways, you have sort of a parallel integrity, and then, it drops down below that critical line, yeah.
The Father rules through His sons on down through the universe organization. There is an unbroken chain of rulers, ending with the planetary princes, who direct the destinies of the evolutionary spheres of the Father's vast domains. It is no mere poetic expression that exclaims, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. He removes kings and sets up kings. The Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men."
Yeah. So, it's one thing that first quote, a little flourish from Psalms, but the second two, pulling them right out and sticking them in your face, pulling them out of Daniel. And saying, it is no mere poetic expression. I point this out a lot. This is one of the very key spots where they're very direct, trying to get you to recognize just what kind of authority can be put into the hands of like our Most High Observer if he assumes a regency. It is no mere poetic expression. If a king needs to be removed, a king will be removed. Whatever needs to be done will be done. And that's tied with the next little, look at the next little paragraph there.
In the affairs of men's hearts, the Universal Father may not always have his way, but in the conduct and destiny of a planet, the divine plan prevails. The eternal purpose of wisdom and love triumphs.
You know, so there's really two fun things in there. And the first one, just, you know, to kind of put you a little bit kind of off guard, you know, in terms of your spiritual consciousness, you know, for them to just say it point blank. In the affairs of men's hearts, the universal Father may not always have his way. Wait a minute, the infinite, eternal, absolute being may not always have his way? You know, why? Because in your inner life, you don't just have three finite dimensions of personality, or even three absent dimensions of personality. You have an absolute dimension. You are on par with the Father in one spot, you know, eternity or not. Okay? He can't force you into eternity. You can say absolutely not. And that's it. You overrule him. He doesn't get his way. The key there with that second part is it's very easy to remember the word destiny in that sentence. And very easy to forget conduct. You know, your spiritual consciousness has no problem with, you know, light and life and visualizing that and thinking about that and going, oh yeah, yeah, the destiny, you know, the Father's going to be there. Finally, it's all going to, you know, be his way. It's not just the destiny. It's the conduct right now, you know. 2 seconds from now, if the Father, wants something a certain way, he will get it his way. There's absolutely nothing that can prevent it. You know, the only place where there's this absolute overrule thing going on is inside, you know, and your relationship to eternity. Everywhere else, he's boss, period. If he activates a most high observer, you know, it's going to go the way the Father wants it to go, period. No one can, you know, even, you know, say, well, I don't know, shouldn't we, you know, talk? No, I mean, yeah. So it's as if the Father is standing there, you know.
Conduct, yeah.
Yeah. So yes, conduct and destiny. The Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. You know, so then the only challenge is to, you know, remember the difference between eternity and time, which your spiritual consciousness always forgets. We're not talking about the Father, you know. The Father wants this cup right here, and there's no way I can move it. You know, it's not trivial things. It's, you know, things that are actually critical. You know, and those are most likely, you know, humans are going to be clueless about what's really critical and what, you know, and what isn't. There's going to be all kinds of things that humans are going to be absolutely certain that if it doesn't happen this way, it's the end of days. You know, and it may be utterly irrelevant. You know, but humans will, you know, just go bananas and start killing each other because they're so certain it's, you know, it's absolutely critical and it's utterly meaningless and irrelevant. You know, and vice versa. Something that humans think is completely meaningless and irrelevant may be absolutely critical. You know, so to have the humility to know that it's probably zero probability that you have any notion of this, you know, what's really critical and what isn't, you have to trust. You have to know that if it actually is critical, the Father has his way, period. There's nothing to worry about. And for the things that aren't critical, buckle up, you know, because it may get bumpy. That's just the way it is.
Do you have any, in studying Daniel, do you have any feeling as to whether he understood the full implications of what he was prophesying?
Remember, when you're reading Daniel, you know, it's just like Revelation. You know, they tell you, but Daniel fully understood these things. There are going to be things in that book which are, you know, a solid reflection of the actual Daniel and what he knew. Then there's going to be a whole bunch of, you know, falderal. And you have to have the objectivity just to, you know, when you're reading it, to say, you know, here, That sounds suspicious. I'll bet you that's not something that someone just made up because it sounded really cool and fit into some apocalyptic notion they had or something. You know, that's probably actually, you know, and, you know, we all know that the moment, you know, that one of the main stories in there is about, you know, removing a king. Okay.
Which one was it, Darius?
You know, I mean, he has, you know, he's very, very likely, you know, the direct agent of making that happen. You know, so, you know, just go in there and read those stories, you know. The writing on the wall sounds very suspicious, like a midway, or those sorts of things, you know.
What's the definition for when the Rancho book uses the term prophet? Because I know they call Samuel a prophet.
Right. I mean, when they say that someone is a prophet, you know, they're validating that. You know, humans call lots of people prophets. If the Revelation says so-and-so actually was a prophet, like Tenskwatawa was actually a prophet, that's interesting. You know, that means that that individual actually was getting some kind of input. You know? I mean, that, you know, they're saying that that isn't just a delusional crazy person or whatever, or someone who was really skilled at, you know, mesmerizing the masses or whatever. That person actually had some sort of real connection, some sort of input. May not have been vast, but there was something, you know, true about what was going on there, which is kind of interesting for them to do, to validate.
You know, when you say that the Father's going to have his way, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the Most High, whether it's directly or through the Master Son, the Most High is doing the will of the Father. And so the Father's having his way. He's not pushing aside the Most High and saying, oh, we're going to do it this way. The Most High already knows in probably 100% of the time what exactly needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the Master Son. Mm-hmm. So the Father is not interfering.
Right.
Because everybody along that whole chain is cooperating and has an in-depth clarity about what the Father really wants.
Right. The simplest example is that one that they point out to us, you know, about that recent regency, where as soon as the Most High stepped forward and said, you know, I'm no longer Most High Observer, I'm now Most High Regent, you know, instantly three personalized adjusters appeared at his side. See, and remember when they're talking about, you know, that, like when we read in that first paragraph, that the Father, you know, at any time can, you know, intervene directly. What does that look like? That doesn't look like some giant hand that comes out of the mists and, you know. That looks like a personalized adjuster. When the Father directly engages time, he does so via a personalized adjuster. The personalized adjuster is a direct expression of the omnipersonal Father at that point in space and time. So, you know, there was no coordination there. There was no elbows. They were perfectly in sync. You know, yeah, the Father and the Most High right there.
You know, if we cooperate, if we are in harmony, if the Father's will is our will, it's the same thing. I mean, obviously you can't,
right,
you can't see it, but if you tap into that thought adjuster, you're seeing pretty good, or eventually you are anyway.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's some potential, but we all know we got a long ways to grow before we're going to be too fancy of a hand of God. All right. You got something?
These prophets, supposed prophets in the Bible, they struggled at first with wanting, they felt like they should share the word of God to the king or whatever, but they struggled with it internally. Yeah.
It's one thing to be a prophet, it's another thing to be Daniel.
Yeah.
Daniel, you know, was much more than a prophet. It's very likely he was a cosmic reservist. That's different. He is part of the planetary government. Okay, he's not just a prophet. Yeah. All right.
Said Jesus, "My Father who gave them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand." As you glimpse the manifold workings and view the staggering immensity of God's well-nigh limitless creation, you may falter in your concept of his primacy, but you should not fail to accept him as securely and everlastingly enthroned at the paradise center of all things, and as the beneficent Father of all intelligent beings. There is but one God and Father of all, who is above all and in all, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist.
And just notice how they word that right in the middle of the paragraph. Okay, so you may falter in your concept of his primacy. We were kind of talking about that, this, you know, how difficult this is. You're very finite. The actions of the infinite are just going to be endlessly shrouded in mystery. You know, and so that the more you become aware of the bigger picture, the more difficult this is going to be to try to somehow sort this out. Okay, so that's one thing. You know, it's one thing to have difficulty in wrapping your mind around the doings of an infinite being. But notice how they say it is, but you should not fail. But it's sad to record. Yeah. You know, it doesn't say you will not fail, you know, but you shouldn't. You should be taking the light and cultivating, you know, the objective consciousness to recognize, you know, what they're saying there, logically, intuitively recognize that in spite of the confusion that you have in your ability to see and analyze and understand all the details, you know, in spite of all appearances to the contrary, you should know with absolute certitude. We can read it there. That he is securely and everlastingly enthroned at the paradise center of all things and is the beneficent father of all intelligent beings, period. That should be an absolute certitude that you can have in spite of all your difficulty as a finite being to understand the doings of even supremacy, let alone infinity. It's very, very important to notice all those little, that's a challenge. You should.
What does beneficent mean?
Benefit, okay? Okay, so, in other words, he is very magnanimous in giving to your benefit. Okay, beneficence. Yep.
The uncertainties of life and the vicissitudes of existence do not in any manner contradict the concept of the universal sovereignty of God. All evolutionary creature life is beset by certain inevitabilities. Consider the following. 1. Is courage, strength of character, desirable? Then must man be reared in an environment which necessitates grappling with hardships and reacting to disappointments.
Okay. Well, like I said, one at a time. Let's reflect a little bit. Notice the word, the wording in there. Then must man be reared in an environment which necessitates. Okay. It may be that you manage to, squeak through this life without too much difficulty. Maybe things just kind of all, happen to fall in place, it happens. But you're not going to get off Gerasim like that. Somewhere between your birth and your departure from Gerasim, you have to take a hold of strength of character. And that's the other thing, it's very important as you go through each of these. They're basically either focusing your recognition of the word that's in italics or really kind of redefining it so that you don't misunderstand with each of these. It's very important to not skip what's in between the M dashes there, that parenthetical after the italicized word. Spiritual strength. Courage is a spirit word, remember. Spirit of courage is in the spirit block here. That's a spirit word. Do you have actual spirit fibers woven into your nature so that when difficulties come, you don't break. They'll keep testing you. Nope, he still breaks. Nope, he still breaks. Nope, he still breaks. You know, and they'll keep breaking you until you choose to not be breakable. Because then and only then can you go on. Breakable things don't make it to paradise. Only unbreakable things make it to paradise. You have to choose to be unbreakable. And they are going to conspire against every effort you make to avoid the necessity of grappling with hardships and reacting to disappointments. It's a vast conspiracy against you. No escaping. So you might as well just face up to it and still take a deep breath and start working on that, because it's an essential part of being able to be in a truly ascending phenomenon. You can't do it as a fragile individuality. You have to have literal unity woven into your being. Okay, you can't wipe your feet on a carpet that only has warp. It has to have woof also. Okay, and the moment you try to wipe your feet on it, it'll just fall apart. You can't just lay strands of beautiful fabric down on the yarn on the floor and expect to wipe your feet on it effectively. Right? It's very simple. It's as simple as that. The universe is going to try to wipe its feet on you, and you better have some spirit fibers running lengthwise through your being.
So if you pray for courage, you get it.
Yeah, be careful. You all know the statement about angels. You know, boy, I'd love to have some real angel engagement. Yeah, yeah. Careful what you ask for. All right, number two.
Is altruism, service of one's fellows, desirable? Then must life experience provide for encountering situations of social inequality?
Okay, so here it is, like I promised. A lot of that should be pretty accessible. Even the parenthetical, okay, service to one's fellows, yeah, altruism, I get that. Okay, that doesn't seem to be too radically different than what I understand.
Okay. Service of one's fellows.
Yeah, service of one's fellows, right? But the social inequality thing, this is, they purposely put that in this little, tiny little set of words that they're choosing to give for each one of these bullet points. They purposely put that in there because this is a big deficit in this whole area of altruism. The lack of understanding of how this whole social inequality thing works. So let's start with, like I said, the first thing you have to begin to understand is what's the difference between the word equity and the word equality. Okay. Start with equity. Okay, the ity suffix. If you put an ity suffix on a word, it means you're making it a noun. It's a state or condition of something or other. Okay, so state or condition of what? What's the root there? That EQU. Sort of basically what that's alluding to is something that you might call balance. Well, if you read that in the dictionary, it's like, okay, so when they coined that word, they had some notion like balance in mind, and that's what they're trying to express, a state of, or condition of balance. Oh, but wait a minute. I've been reading the Revelation and thinking about this a lot. When I hear the word balance, I know where this is going. Balance, proportion, symmetry, harmony. Okay, no. Balance, proportion, symmetry. Okay, that's seventh adjutant. Harmony. Okay, that's a cosmic word. That word is saying that you're in a state or condition of a cosmic character. Harmony is what that word is pointing to. Remember always that there's a fact on high that is vaguely recognized down below and is expressed as a word. You need to follow it up through our ignorance back to its source to understand what the why we have the word in the language. What is it actually referring upward to? Okay, so equity is a cosmic word. And your clue is just what they were trying to get at. Like balance, like, oh yes, yeah, a cosmic balance, harmony. Okay, now equality. The only difference between equity and equality in terms of the letters is there's an AL attached to the, you know, to the root there before they stick the ITY on the end. You know, it's another state or condition of something. But what does it mean if they take the EQU and they stick an AL suffix on it? What does the AL suffix mean? That means of or like. Oh, okay. So equality is equity-like. It's like equity. Well, in what way? Well, I mean, everyone knows when you say the word equal, okay, is that a unity word? Yeah, it's obviously, you know, we all know we have the notion of unity attached to the word equal. Okay. Oh, it's equity-like. Okay, so in other words, I have a sphere, a cosmic sphere of equity. And I project that onto a spiritual plane. That circle of equality is equity-like. But see, it's just the spirit essence of that equity. Equality is the spirit essence of equity. You know, it's that unity motivation that's behind, you know, all the effort it's going to take to establish something called equity. It's that spirit engine within equity. But you can think of it very, you know, in terms of just the, you know, the suffixes there and the literal construction of the word, it's equity-like. It's a spirit projection. You know, it's a projection onto the spirit plane. Okay? So the circle is not the sphere. The circle is really, you know, symmetric like a sphere. It's sphere-like, but it's not a sphere. It's just the circle part of the sphere. Okay? So when you're thinking about this, you know, that's the basic truth behind us coining those two words. You can now understand those words better than any human has ever understood. Why we have those two words? What's the source of them? There's a cosmos, and cosmos is spirit, and you know is unity and individuality woven together. The unity essence of it is the equality. Well, what's the other part of it? You know, if you take that equality essence and you face facts with it, if you find a way through wisdom to figure out how to relate the spirit essence, the equality part, to the individuality facts, you'll have a superadditive consequence in the relationship between the two, and that is the equity. You will establish an equity in that context. Yeah. The problem, see, with equality is it doesn't have the facts. It's just this unity part. It's just the spirit essence part of the picture. Okay, so now let's flip it around. Okay, you've got the notion of social inequality. I mean, let's just take a simple example that's, you know, stood for ages in mankind. Female, male. You know, only in very modern times has there been any extensive recognition that males and females are spiritually equal. I mean, it has long been thought that they were not spiritually equal. Equals a spirit word, spiritually equal. So you socialize that notion, and you have a socialized expression, you have a cultural expression of inequality. Okay, so you finally, you know, mankind progresses, and finally we have enough objective consciousness to see this. Like, wait a minute, there's a social inequality there. I mean, men and women are spiritually equal. Now comes the problem. You now have a motivation. You see that there's a lack of perfection in the system. You've used your spiritual consciousness as an error detector. All is not right in front of me. Now what do you do? Do you think, well, the solution to social inequality is social equality? Isn't that obvious? Well, that's what your spirit consciousness would think. No, you know, the answer to social inequality is not the illusion, the unattainable of social equality. There is no such thing as social equality. There's only social equity. You know, once I recognize that male and that female are spiritually equal, do I have a material consciousness also? It goes, now that I really have that clear that the spiritually they're equal, it's very obvious just how different they are mindily and materially. You know, if you don't have the eyes to see the matter in the mind, but only the spirit, you think that what you're going to try to do is establish social equality. And that's impossible. There is no such thing. You know, men and women are different materially and mindily. It doesn't matter how much you know, ignore that. It doesn't change the fact. They are different, period. And you have to face that fact and adjust them to the spiritual ideals and establish an equitous system. You know, we want social equity. We want a system that recognizes the spiritual equality and also recognizes the material and mindal difference and utilizes that material and mindal difference to the advantage of the whole. If you try to make them interchangeable parts, you know, I mean, if that was the point, to treat them as interchangeable parts, then God wouldn't have made them different in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It seems to me if you whitewash these differences with that spiritual brush completely, you're just negating the respect for the mother. You really are. Mm-hmm. Because she's the one that's providing that material and mindal, you know? And you're just whitewashing the father's.
Right. You have a spiritual father, but you have a cosmic mother. And so, you know, just saying that, I mean, are the gears already turning? Do you appreciate why they embedded that? You know, they have this, you know, notice it's a pretty short one. It may even be the shortest one. Yeah, it's the shortest little blurb, but it's huge. You know, when you get the notion of altruism in your head and you're all mixed up about equality and equity, it's a mess, you know. Think of all the times in the book when they say things that are very harsh to your spiritual consciousness that are predicated on this fact. They're trying to get us to stop doing this. You need to be altruistic, but not with your eyes closed. You have to treat the facts objectively. Open your eyes. You can't pretend that everyone is innately divine, and you can just use every person as an interchangeable part and some perfect, you know, light and, you know. And just, I mean, even when a world is in the seventh stage of light and life, there isn't social equality. In Havona, there's no social equality. There is no such thing. That there is equity, very, very high expressions of equity, but social equality is an illusion. Of having the one eye closed. Yeah. So that's, so just kind of keep that in mind the next time you're reading something like, you know, let's say you're reading about, you know, the three marriage and family papers. And there's some zingers in there. You know, they start talking about genetic things and stuff, and it gets very scary for your spiritual consciousness. Keep that in mind. That's harkening back to here. You know, the problems that the Christian church has had over the last 2,000 years. They've got all this spiritual motivation, and Luke told them to go out and establish social equality, and it's really been a problematic thing.
Chris, yep. A neighboring planet is a good example of a lot of things, you know, one family to a house and so much land.
Right. And now, of course, see, they established some equity in their system, but they made it easier by simplifying the system. Let's just, you know, ship out or kill everyone that's too complicated to harmonize into the system, and then we can make a nice little harmony with us. You know, it's practically, you know, monolithic to start with. It's like, how hard is it to harmonize it? Yeah, that's why, you know, the melting pot that is the United States has got a huge challenge in this. I mean, if you're going to bring in all this diversity, harmony is not an easy task. It's going to take very high measures of objective consciousness to be able to see how to harmonize the system. You can't do it as a flatlander. You know, and we have all these people who are trying to do it as a flatlander, and it's only going to make things worse, better. You know, they have the best of intentions, but it's going to collapse civilization. So that's a very loaded one there, the altruism. The attempt to actualize social equality. You know, there's a couple spots in the book where they directly tell you that is going to catastrophically implode civilization if you keep that up. If you keep trying to actualize those false initial assumptions. Yeah, and I want to go off and, you know, all that, but, you know, there's, you know, just remember there's spots in the book that are trying to educate us about that. And if you're interested in those areas of human endeavor, seek out those spots in the book where they're trying to help us have better initial assumptions in those areas, political, social, you know, economic, whatnot areas.
If the ultimate goal is to blend the races,
yeah. Blended in wisdom.
But not equally.
Wisdom.
Equitably.
Yeah. What I mean, to create an overall blended race so that we eventually obliterate all the colors.
Right. See, but again, that's just another.
What do they call it?
We don't want to go too far off of here. But just, again, there's a, you know, that's just reminding us of how difficult this is right now for our spiritual consciousness that wants to express unity. You know, and you hear blend the races, like, oh yeah, that sounds unity-like to me, let's just do it. You know, and they say, no, don't do that. because you have no wisdom about how that, you know, that is not a trivial thing. You don't just pour it all together.
Well, it didn't happen, you know? Yeah.
Right, and all these things, you know. So, you know, the wisdom to do it equitably and not just with this burning desire for equality, that's the, you know, that's the rub. Okay, so equality is a spirit word. Social is not a spirit word. Okay, I mean you can't. I mean, it's like saying, well, I can directly actualize an ideal. I don't need to think about ideas. I can just directly express an ideal. No, you can't. You have to translate an ideal into an idea. The only way, you know, social is the associative domain. Okay, so you know, you fundamentally have to have facts in play. And the problem with that notion of social equality is that you're thinking that all you have to worry about is just that very intriguing word equality, and you're just going to socialize that equality. In other words, you're just going to spread equalness everywhere.
Like women get the same pay as men? Is that an example?
Well, I mean, no.
I mean, what is I'm lost on that.
No,
what
I mean.
What are we doing that we're not supposed to be doing as far as social equality?
Not to say that this is what you should do, but just, you know, take that simple little thing that you just said there. Your spiritual consciousness says pay should be equal. It's like, well, no, they should be recognized as spiritually equal, but you know, it may be completely wrong for them to have the exact same jobs or exact same, you know, or whatever. I mean, all of these individualities, material issues, need to be put into a cosmic balance. What makes it work If you just take every single material thing that you can think of about men and women and put an equal sign between them, you have no equity. You have the notion of equality being manifest, and that's not the way they're designed. Men and women are designed to be different, to be functioning differently in society, having different roles, perhaps different. Remember when you're talking about pay and stuff like that. I mean, what is money? I mean, money is the way we regulate our interpersonal relationships. If you try to make it all on a plane, that's called anarchy. That's anarchism. I mean, there's going to be in an equitable system. There's going to be some hierarchy. There's going to be people with more pay and people with less pay. And that's not wrong. That's a hierarchy. See, that's a problem with not opening your material consciousness eye. It leads you right into where Lucifer went. Lucifer, all he had was his unity eye open. And so he immediately says, well, you know, what we need to do is level everything. This hierarchy is evil. We need to, you know, put everything on a plane. Everyone is exactly equal on a plane. That's what your spiritual consciousness thinks is the right thing to do. And it's not. Because God didn't make everything on a plane. He made things in a hierarchy. This is the way it is. Now, I mean, obviously in some simple little thing where, you know, there really isn't any, if it's just a very mechanical job, I mean, obviously men and women are treated the same there because you're not treating them as persons. You're treating them as machines. Okay, so you can, you know, treat them equally. They're probably equal machines in that area. Now, sometimes the machine role might be, you know, men are usually stronger, okay? So you can't, you know, just throw out that fact. You know, there's all these issues have to come in. But, you know, if you boil it down to something very trivial, well, then there ought to be, you know, then the equality thing can be directly expressed. You know, so many dollars an hour, you know, to move your hand like this. Okay, I mean, men and women can move their hand just as, you know, well, and well, like that. But other things, you know, once you go beyond simplistic things like that, you've got to take into the differences into account. And that means if you're going to have, you know, if you're going to have money to regulate interpersonal relationships, there's going to be money differentials. The moment that you recognize factual differences, there's going to be money differentials. That's just the way it is.
Well, I'm thinking of, like, equal before the law and equal rights. You know, those are social issues.
Well, but again, it's, see, when you bring in the word right, like righteousness, yeah, that's a high word. Rights, you know, true rights should be tied to a recognition of spiritual equality. Mm-hmm. The problem is we have this strong tendency to it's like, oh, that was so cool. Let's make everything a right. Things that don't have anything to do with spiritual equality. See, and that's the problem. Going beyond the domain of the appropriateness of equality. I mean, you know, it's not treating men and women as spiritually equal to say that women cannot relate to God as well as men. You know, and anything that's predicated on that assumption that God loves men more than women, I mean, any social expression of that, see, that's an expression of social inequality, you know, and you need to get rid of that. But be careful. Don't go beyond those things that are directly tied to that false notion of spiritual inequality between, say, a man and a woman. And that's the challenge, is not to overstep the bounds.
Women in the past 20 years, I think, have made disproportionate gains.
Go back and read, you know, again, the Marriage and Family, what they say about women. You know, they talk about this a number of times in there. They say, okay, now women, you've made some really significant gains in recent time. You know, in getting the recognition of your spiritual equality expressed socially, where it should be expressed socially. Now that you have recognition as being a spiritual equal, are you up to the challenge of the responsibility? No. Remember how many times I say, you know, now are you going to drop the ball? You know, after all these years of struggle, are you as women going to drop the ball? You know, think about what's behind those statements when they say that. You know, what's behind those statements is, are you going to forget that there's some things that you were designed to be different? If you let go of those areas that only you can hold, then it all collapses. There are some things that you must do that a man can't do, and it may mean that you're not going to get as much recognition as the man, because he's going to be out there doing groovy things and getting trophies and whatnot, and you're not, or whatever. But that's, you know, can you recognize your duty? You know, can men recognize their duty as men, and can women recognize their duty as women? Or do they, you know, say, well, you know, the easiest way is to just forget about the whole duty thing and just go down and be animals, you know, together.
One of the biggest injustices begins when children are being raised, because little girls are allowed to get away with certain behaviors that little boys are not, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and part of what handicaps the different men and women when they become older is that they're emotionally crippled in different ways.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the way we rear children.
And just appreciate, you know, just to say one more thing on this, that we all know some of these historical problems, like you're saying. The unfortunate thing, they tell you, you're just starting to overcome some of those long-standing historical errors and replacing them by, you know, other errors.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's not getting any better, guys. And the unfortunate thing is, and sometimes when you're doing that, you're replacing a material issue with a spirit, you know, a material-like error with more of a spirit-like error. And then starts to get dangerous. You know, we've talked about that so many times. Every time they're pointing to that, they use the word danger in the book. It's like, okay, that's unfortunate. This is dangerous. You could really do some serious damage to civilization if you keep down that track. You know, it's not just going to slow down the progress of things. You know, it could collapse things. So that, all right, so.
But I think if you were to go to every single person that's in the Occupy movement or people that support that and talk to everybody, you'd find that there's a fair amount of people in there that have no problem with the hierarchy concept.
Mm-hmm.
What they have a problem with is the corruption of it and the blatant unfairness and imbalance in the hierarchy system.
And just take that one little thought that you have there, and that's the point. Look in the book where they're trying to help us to separate those two things. The problem is that we blur things together. See, and our spiritual consciousness makes this worse. It wants to blur more and more things together than humans have ever blurred together before. I mean, there are things that need to be done, relative to new legislation, increasing philanthropy, and industrial reorganization for, you know, basic issues of efficiency, fairness, you know, some just basic rudimentary issues, justice, etc. The problem is, you know, when you step outside of the appropriate domains of those and try to use those techniques to do things that they can't do, like alter genetics. I mean, it doesn't matter how much, you know, you increase philanthropy, it doesn't change DNA. There are some things, some human inequality has nothing to do with, these sort of misadaptations of things, you know, like social injustice. Some things have to, you know, are not... They're not about the failure to recognize spiritual equality and socialize it properly. They are material issues. They're not you know, spiritual issues at all. They're material issues. And the inability of humans to separate the two, you know, is a growing problem. We need to clearly separate them so that we can very directly focus on fixing the things that we need to fix, that are expressions of that are enculturations of social inequality. But then there's these material things, and they're a separate issue, and they're going to take a long time to work out. There's no way that we can just snap our fingers and fix those material things. Especially, because of the rebellion and the fall. We've got some really problematic material issues that no amount of idealism is going to fix. Not even the life carriers know how some of these material issues are going to get fixed. They admit that. So that's the whole point. The reason there's a problem is not, just stop thinking of it in dichotomy. Just say that you got to be careful. A lot of people think, well, okay, so we should just let the robber barons screw us all. No, we need to carefully separate the material and the spiritual issues so we don't get them blurred together. Okay.
Just as an aside to this, this conversation is not even possible mm-hmm. in most circles to mm-hmm. have on this level. What we have to understand partly is the Urantia book allows for the contextualization of all of this in a way that when you bring this up in public, I mean, what can you talk about with regard to, I mean, he mentioned DNA. How far down that line do you want to go?
Right. You'll be crucified the second you open your mouth.
Okay. I mean, and on and on and on. The whole, just even the concept of separating material spiritual issues and having an art of living, let alone having an art of living to compose the two. These are concepts that haven't entered, the minds of most people on our planet. They're in one aspect of the dichotomy or another.
Right. And that's the problem. And so it has to start with a small handful of people who've recognized the revelation and have put a lot of effort into aggressively challenging all of the preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices that you've been immersed in all your life, and to allow the revelation to reform you, to think about this in a way that no one out there is thinking about. There's not a single expert on the planet that you can turn to for the answers to these problems. They're all errors. All the thoughts are errors. They might be very compelling to your spiritual consciousness or very compelling to your material consciousness, but none of them are cosmic. It's sad to record that so few persons, okay, that isn't out there. The answers are not out there. The answers are only here. They're only in here. And until you can see how different the thoughts in here are than any thoughts that you've had until you started challenging yourself with the revelation, nothing's going to change.
In the same way that you're teaching these truths in a way that make them easier to understand for everybody in this room, in that same way, each of us need to be with our neighbor, our friend, whoever it is out there, learning to translate these concepts into terms and language that those people can hear.
How many hours do you think it took me to finally figure out what the difference between equality and equity is? Well, I mean, it took really, I'm 51. Okay, that's how long it took. Okay? And you can read the book for years and years and it never even occurs to you. And then one day it's like, wait a minute. Oh, I get it. Well, now that's so clear. Now I understand why that sounded good, but it's a sophistry. Because it's ignoring the facts. I get it. So you can finally break yourself out of these, remember, you're a helpless victim of the a priori assumptions? Until you can finally recognize, it's like, well, that all sounded dandy until now that I have my eyes open. And it's like, oh, I see what that goes. That only goes well for about 10 minutes. And then things start going really, really poorly. You know, but that was not obvious until I had an objective point of view. It seemed like it was innately divine before, and now it's, oh dear. Okay, that's everything has to have a transformation like that. You know, behold, all things are becoming new. That's what you're looking for. All right, let's keep going. Now we've got done enough negativity. Let's do hope.
Then human existence must constantly be confronted with insecurities and recurrent uncertainties.
Okay. Is hope. Grandeur of trust desirable? There is a real challenging upstepping of the word hope. Okay? And they play off of that. If you look carefully at the words, then human existence must constantly be confronted. Okay? What's the difference between what's going on with hope, relative to hope, with the faint flicker of faith, and what they're talking about here? Okay, the faint flicker of faith perspective of things is, okay, I'm coming to terms a bit with these inevitabilities. I've read them 20 times, and it's like, okay, every once in a while I can deal with, you know, insecurities and uncertainties. No, it's not what you're looking for. You're not looking for what that faint flicker of faith can do. You're looking for the kind of hope that can only be described as something that comes not from faith, but from trust. Hope that is a grandeur of trust, is grand consequence of something called trust. Something that can deal with being constantly confronted. Every second. Okay? Mere faith will not withstand that. You know, mere faith is going to falter in the midst of a constant assault. But, you know, there is grace, mercy, and that's why, you know, we haven't all collapsed. But they're reminding you, between here and Gerasim, we're going to keep turning up the volume, okay? We're going to get it to the point where there's a constant assault, but you stand unmoved.
Yeah. Do we get vacations?
You do get vacations.
No, yeah,
you know, it's like, oh, now I'm starting to understand why they have a whole regime called reversion directors.
Yeah, we need that here.
Wow, am I really going to need it there? I mean, it's like, okay, can I just breathe for a second? Just give me a couple seconds. I'm in your game, but okay, all right. And they say, yes, you can go aside for a second, take a couple deep breaths, you know, laugh a little bit, but then back out. Okay, it's like, yeah, I'm ready for it. I can do it. You know, you'll delight in being able to express the grandeur of trust instead of just that little faint flicker of tenuous, you know. It's like, wouldn't it be cool when you can look and see grandeur pouring forth from you? Yeah, that's what you know. Yeah, is that desirable? Yeah, see, that's desirable. Yeah. Well, then you're going to have to take up the challenge. All right, next one.
Good?
Yeah.
This sounds, you know, that trust sounds a lot like, looking at your feet and adjusting it to the facts at hand. I'm learning to trust.
Yeah. Thanks for, I should have mentioned this. And remind you again how important it is to reflect on the two expressions, spiritual faith on the one hand, soul trust on the other hand. What's the difference between those two? One is just spirit substance. One is material and spiritual substance woven together. Grow your spiritual faith into soul trust. Soul is literally a substance that is yours. The spirit, you know, you have contact with is just, you know, on loan. You know, you continuously touch it. Okay, you can't really, you know, the mind, you know, You're not going to be able to do that really full bore until you're a first stage spirit. Okay? But soul, that's yours. You know, get a hold of soul trust. It's a substance. It can be pounded on, and it holds firm. And that's what, so those are it's a really nice contrasting, you know, use of adjectives: spiritual faith, soul trust.
There's one more. Mm-hmm. Assurance.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. See, and that's the assurance. You know, faith, trust, assurance. You grow faith into trust, and then there's actual assurance possible. And you can stand on the rock. And with assurance, I know no real harm can befall me. That's trust. That's not mere faith. Yeah. Now, the way faith comes in there, there's faith and there's living faith. Living faith and trust are similar. Yeah. But mere faith is very tenuous. Okay, and look and see how they're touching upon that. Look at how the parenthetical in the next one.
Is faith the supreme assertion of human thought desirable? Then must the mind of man find itself in the troublesome predicament where it ever knows less than it can believe.
Okay. Do you define faith as the supreme assertion of human thought? Okay. So what are they getting at here? Effort, struggle, conflict, faith. Okay, why does the word faith come after those first effort, struggle, conflict, faith? Okay, no, and they're reminding you that it can go as high as it needs to. Supreme assertion. You come up against a conflict. What do you do next? You reach up. And you grasp a hold of something that's above that conflict with your faith grasp. You grasp a hold of what's above and you pull yourself up over that conflict. You rise up to a level that exists above that conflict. Okay. And there's no limit, you know, of finite issues that this won't work. If you need a supreme faith grasp, it's there for your taking. Okay. So faith is the initiating, you know, act. That's your father-like thing. You know, where did that, you know, that ability to exert faith come from? From the Father. Right? He made you a person. That faith grasp from the Father can initiate a process that can, you know, that can get you beyond that conflict. He initiates it, and then your relationship to the mother takes you through. You know, effort, struggle, conflict, faith, and then determination, love, loyalty, progress. Yeah. You know, the nature of your mind in the wake of that assertion of faith gets you to the progress. Yeah. All right. How about the next one?
Five, is the love of truth and the willingness to go wherever it leads desirable? Then must man grow up in a world where error is present and falsehood always possible.
Okay. We're getting in to a little bit of first cosmic intuition here. Love of truth. Those are fun words for your spiritual consciousness. Okay, love of truth. Boy, I like to, you know, those should feel like I want to say that a lot. I want to say love of truth a lot. Love of truth. Okay, but love of truth is not misty-eyed belief. You know, love of truth is not misty-eyed belief. Love of truth. Okay, a truth seeker is someone who is constantly attempting to refute their ideas. They're a truth seeker. There's no belief involved here. They have the courage, the willingness to go wherever it leads. courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Okay? You know, is it desirable to not be a helpless victim of some falsehood that has oozed into one of your ears from somewhere in the cacophony around us? Is it desirable to not be living a life predicated on a false initial assumption? It should be desirable if you love truth. That's what they're getting at. So get at it. Use your gifts to start challenging the ideas in your head. It's like, wait a minute, let me put you to the test, idea. My spiritual consciousness loves you, but I need to test you. I need to be more godlike. God tests things that he loves. Okay? I'm going to test you. Okay? And let's see if you can stand up to my best attempts to objectively refute you. You aren't trying to refute things because you don't want to believe them, you know, and you're looking for an easy rationalization scheme. That's not what refutation is. Refutation is you would only do that because, you know, that feels solid, but let me go at it. Let me put it to the test. And if I can't break it, maybe it's worth actually taking step two. But I'm not going to take step two based upon that initial assumption. If I can break it, it's just 5 minutes of reflection. How silly would that be? No, I want to live my whole life predicated on the first random thing that pops into my head. And I'm just going to believe. Okay? Yeah, it's like, that's not desirable. That's completely undesirable. You don't want to do that. Okay? You want to be a lover of truth. Actual truth. You're going to courageously be willing to go wherever it leads. You're going to consecrate your will in such a way that you're willing to be revealed to and reformed. Are you willing to be reformed? Someone's going to grab you and go. You have the courage to allow that? Yeah. The moment that you consecrate your will to the Father, the mother jumps in and starts remolding you. Most people don't have the courage to allow for revelation and reformation. Too scary. They would much sooner just be content with the thoughts that they have. And if they can stumble upon a book that has a lot of really groovy words in it, you know, and cool poetic passages that they can use as an affirmation of their preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, you know, it's all the easier to maintain this, you know. Yeah. It's not affirmation, it's revelation. And if you don't have the courage for revelation and reformation, stop reading it. I mean,
6. Is idealism, the approaching concept of the divine, desirable? Then must man struggle in an environment of relative goodness and beauty, surrounding stimulative of the irrepressible reach for better things.
Idealism. You know, we're always a little bit worried about the ism suffix, throwing zeal at something. Well, what's the problem, though, with the ism suffix? It's when you put it onto an idea. You're not supposed to have zeal for ideas. You're supposed to have zeal for ideals. Oh, well, that's the root. Okay. So it's okay to have zeal for ideals, idealism. But, you know, you notice how usually I say spiritual idealism is a little reminder. Because it's very easy to get confused and think that an idea is an ideal. You need to constantly challenge yourself on that. You know, is that an idea or an ideal that I'm wanting to throw zeal at?
Number 5 would fix that.
Right. Number 5 would be very helpful. I wonder if that's why they put it before that. Right.
Even a sequence.
Yeah, there's even a sequence here, perhaps. See? All right. Okay. That, you know, so spiritual idealism, yes. You know, in the sense of, look at how they again help, the approaching concept of the divine. Not the present. And that's where it always gets difficult. See, you know, it's like, no, this is not just any old idea. This is the idea. I mean, absolutism is appropriate here. See, that's where you're getting in dangerous territory. See, to see it, to see yourself living in a perfecting universe, and being a perfecting being, so that there's an ing, an approaching concept of the divine, and this spiritual idealism that you're relating to is in that context. The irrepressible reach for better things. Get the ing in there. See, you recognize an ideal, but you're not just going to sit there and bliss out with it. You know, you actually want to go out and try to do something with it. So you figure out how to translate that ideal into an idea, and you apply it. But tomorrow is a different day. Tomorrow, you're going to try to get a better idea distilled out of that ideal. The ideal stays constant, but the idea is better every day. Every day, you translate that ideal into a better idea. Okay? That process is called following truth. If you don't see any need to have a better translation of the ideal into an idea tomorrow than today, then you're not following the truth. You're not a truth seeker. You're a believer, you know, in the absoluteness of the idea that you translated today. Let us institutionalize this idea. Legacy, tradition, convention. The future is about turning that idea into a convention that stands for all time. See that? No. That's not, you know, and I'm going to get misty-eyed about it, and that's loving the truth of it. No. See, that's not, all right. So again, see how they play together? All right, so Chris noticed, you know, those two are kind of working together, 5 and 6, and it seems predicated on the logical acumen, the first cosmic intuition. Look what comes next.
Is loyalty, devotion to highest duty, desirable? Then must man carry on amid the possibilities of betrayal and desertion. The valor of devotion to duty consists in the implied danger of default.
Duty. What are the three words they give to name those three cosmic levels that the three cosmic intuitions are related to? Causation, duty, is next. You know, causation, duty, worship, right? Yeah. Duty, see, is next. Devotion to highest duty. You know, again, loyalty. You know, we've talked about, when you go to the third adjutant here, you have the energy of loyalty, and then in a personal context, it can be the spirit of courage. And the problem there is courage is upward, but loyalty can be upward or downward. It can be loyalty to baser things, or loyalty to highest duty, you know, devotion to highest duty. A devotion to cosmic duty. You want a supreme loyalty to cosmic duty. The duty that's in that causation, duty, worship. Just like the worship that's in that set of three, we're not talking about the religious impulse here. We're not talking about the sixth adjutant. We're talking about cosmic duty. Something way above that first inkling of duty that, you know, you might get down lower. Okay. Causation, duty, worship. Okay, cosmic duty, this highest duty, you know, the kind of duty that can only be taken on, you know, devotion to, can only be taken on if you are attempting to move towards supreme loyalty. Not just immediate loyalty, supreme loyalty, loyalty that embraces the whole of the grand universe. Supreme loyalty. And what does that look like even? Okay. But that's the challenge. And again, all these desirables. What's always in play is you can, once you think about this, you can recognize that there's something way beyond anything that you've ever tried before. And if you somehow could achieve that, that's desirable. I could be so much more. I desire to be so much more than I am. Well, nothing's automatic. It's going to take a lot of work. But use the desire. See, use that spiritual energy to drive you into this difficult process of effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, progress. And loyalty is going to be a key one in there. It was one of the words along that path. You need to challenge loyalty to be upward. You need to be ever vigilant. Watch for loyalty. Maybe it doesn't go down, but it might go sideways. Okay? Be ever vigilant on that one. That's one where it would be really helpful if you had this truth seeker, this true seeker notion in mind. It's like, wait a minute. I'm having a desire to put loyalty, direct loyalty over there. Let's put that to the test. Is that true loyalty or false loyalty? Because the last thing I want to do is start pumping spiritual energy into a false loyalty. At least I hope that's undesirable.
Chris, can I say that the five human loyalties on page 2094 are also what's implied here in it, with the personal honor, family love, religious obligation, social duty, economic necessity.
Right, and just right the details are one thing. Just what the reason they have this up front here is as you go forward in the book, every time that issue of duty comes up somewhere, try to challenge yourself to have devotion to the highest duty that you can recognize in that area. Not the good enough for government work duty in that area. Not the path of least resistance duty in that area. The highest duty. And you're not going to immediately know what that even is, but the point is to be challenging yourself to, this irrepressible reach for better things. I don't want to just have the duty that I recognize today. I want to be able to see higher duty and take on the challenge every day. As soon as I get my feet placed at one, I'm immediately going to be trying to take it to the next notch.
Guess what tomorrow's bread is.
Yeah. Okay. So you see, there's actually a common thread, through a lot of these. And that's why they're the inevitabilities.
Eight, is unselfishness, the spirit of self-forgetfulness, desirable? Then must mortal man live face to face with the incessant clamoring of an inescapable self for recognition and honor. Man could not dynamically choose the divine life if there were no self-life to forsake. Man could never lay saving hold on righteousness if there were no potential evil to exalt and differentiate the good by contrast.
Okay. Maybe just one little thought to bring in there. Does anyone have an immediate associative thought when they say self-forgetfulness?
Worship.
Causation, duty, worship. Yeah, see?
Yeah.
See how it's in order here? Right. Remember when they were talking about true prayer and true worship?
Yeah.
On the one hand, true prayer is self-reminding, sublime thinking. On the other hand, true worship is self-forgetting, super thinking. Okay? So to look at the differential they're throwing into the notion of unselfishness. They're directly associating it with true worship. So at the same time that they're kind of challenging your notions of what unselfishness means, they're challenging your notion of what worship means. And reflect on that. Well, and humility, of course. And trust. You know, we've talked about that. That whole bit about why you would turn and put yourself at your back and face the cosmos. Your adjuster's got your back. You can trust the adjuster. It's going to be okay. You know, courageously turn, you know, and engage the cosmos. That you need to forsake that self-life. Your relation to that self-life is sublime. This is where the solidity should be, you know, in your engagement of the cosmos. All right, and the last one.
9. Is pleasure, the satisfaction of happiness, desirable? Then must man live in a world where the alternative of pain and the likelihood of suffering are ever-present experiential possibilities.
Everyone knows that. Pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. Okay, look at what they're doing to the word pleasure there. Yeah. The word pleasure, boy, is that not like the word love, huh, in terms of basal notions attached to it? Okay. The satisfaction of happiness. Defining the word pleasure to mean the satisfaction of happiness. Okay, now there's joy, which is a spiritual experience. But happiness results from choice. Okay. And the satisfaction of happiness is pleasure. Okay? Happiness results from choice. What's the choice in play? It's the same thing that we've been, you know, it's been threaded through every one of these. You know, we ended where we began. Pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. Okay? It just is. You know, essential, the essence of. I mean, it's the essence of the finite. There is a differential. It's just there. And when you stick your finger into it, it zaps you. You know, it's painful. And there's a burden, you know, that you bear. It's suffering. You know, it's literally you're underneath. You're bearing this downward burden upon your shoulders. Okay? And on it's there. It's there. But can you bring all of these higher senses, higher potentials of yourself into play so that you can take it all the way down to this last line? You directly allow the tension to be there. You know that there's no way to avoid, at least for any length of time, the pain and suffering that are essential, you know, fact that results from that differential. It's going to be there. But can you choose to be happy in the face of that? In spite of all appearances of the contrary. Remember how the Jesus affirmation ends. Okay? That pain and suffering, those are all appearances to the contrary. They're going to be there. But can you choose to be happy in the midst of that? You can be blissfully ignorant, but that's not going to get you very far. Allow them to enter in. Choose to use the gifts that have been given to you to establish a stability with them by bringing what's above them into them. Okay? Don't just try to somehow float above them and bliss and joy. Choose to bring the joy down into the pain and suffering, and you'll get something that's more desirable, more pleasurable, more satisfying, okay, than mere joy. Happiness. Happiness is knowing that you've succeeded in being a cosmic phenomenon. You've brought the spiritual and the material together. Okay. You can spend just endless time, see, reflecting on this. This is a masterfully crafted thing here. The order and everything. There's all kinds of stuff that, you know, I didn't even bring up. But you get the sense, I hope, of, it's a magnificent, everyone knows it's a magnificent passage. You know, you can't help but be struck by it. You know, everyone knows what page it's on in the original single column, you know. But again, the irrepressible reach for better things. Constantly challenge yourself to take your relationship with the inevitabilities to the next notch. Keep going forward with it. Notice how many things you've missed in it, you know, how much more it could challenge you, and how much more satisfying it could be if you could find a way to meet those greater challenges, rather than just being content, you know, where you are, and being, you know, one must do something as well as be something. You know, we know that's the challenge of the fifth epical revelation. All right, so you got a little, yeah? Yep,
I'll check. I was just thinking, when Andre said the art of living, I put that as the parenthetical, is civility, the art of living, desirable. Mm-hmm. And when Terry said play, is play the romp of joy, desirable, and you said humor. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's obviously the revelators chose these nine, very well, and for a purpose. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of others, and as we go through life, to do exactly what you were saying, identify the quality, and just think in your own mind, okay, what is the parenthetical? That is the highest concept. This is the challenge. Right. If we can go through life, you're driving down the road, and you think about patience or kindness or anything. Mm-hmm. Lawfulness, driving on the right side of the road, whatever. Yeah. Then put that parenthetical. Mm-hmm. You and your thought adjuster and your angels, what is that parenthetical? And is that desirable? Okay. Now I've got something to point to. Mm-hmm. And then, as a further challenge, write yourself a little paragraph, as they do here. Mm-hmm. And that helps you identify not just these nine. Yeah. Don't solidify these nine or any nine as, you know, the bedrock of reality, because God is infinite. Love is infinite. There are millions of qualities and aspects thereof. Yeah. That's the challenge, to find that balance in all of them. Just as, you know, it's interesting that it's at the end of, here's God's qualities that we're going to mention, and his attributes that we're going to mention, but they're infinite.
Yeah, and just one little thing that you brought up in there, there's a good little point to bring into this about happiness. That parenthetical is there, you know, to set your sights beyond the difficulty of the moment. And it's like, okay, I can do this thing because I know it's the first step in getting to that. See, that's one of the ways that you bring happiness into this. Bring that foresight. Use your personality to bring that foresight, you know, into place there. You're not going to magically make the facts different here, but you're going to see the facts differently. You're going to see them as step one in an internal process to an ever expanding horizon of desirability. Okay, now they take a little seeming twist, a little turn in the road here.
Throughout the universe, every unit is regarded as a part of the whole. Survival of the part is dependent on cooperation with the plan and purpose of the whole. the wholehearted desire and perfect willingness to do the Father's divine will. The only evolutionary world without error, the possibility of unwise judgment, would be a world without free intelligence. In the Havona universe, there are a billion perfect worlds with their perfect inhabitants, but evolving man must be fallible if he is to be free. Free and inexperienced intelligence cannot possibly at first be uniformly wise. The possibility of mistaken judgment, evil, becomes sin only when the human will consciously endorses and knowingly embraces a deliberate immoral judgment.
Does that strike you as a little bit of a non sequitur from where we just were? But notice what's going on there. I mean, how does it start out? I mean, how many times did they invoke the notion of the whole there? For instance, you know, just carefully notice the and. The wholehearted desire and perfect willingness. Okay? Consecration of your will to the perfect will of God the Father. Okay, that's part of the, you know, the process. The other part is, it can't be the illusion that this is being done in the heart, and it can't even be in the heart but only part of the heart, like half-hearted. Okay? It needs to be wholehearted. You need to get yourself up into the temple, and you need to embrace the whole of the temple. You need a wholehearted desire and a perfect willingness. See, and it's in that context that they're mentioning error and evil. And this is a really important little, I've mentioned this before, to reflect on these nice little definitions of the contrast between error and evil that's in this paragraph. It's one of the most productive or most helpful spots in the entire book about this. To think about the difference between unwise judgment and mistaken judgment. Error is unwise judgment. Evil is mistaken judgment. What's the difference between those two? Okay, unwise judgment. Error. We've talked about this when you have, fact, truth, goodness, figment, falsehood, badness. You start out by grace with the initial encirclement of the Holy Spirit. There's this initial inertia of goodness. It's just in play. You don't even recognize it. The first thing so it's there. The goodness is there. And then you start to engage the individuality. And you want to associate that goodness to fact. Because it would be unwise to associate that goodness with figment. That would be an error. It's unwise judgment to take goodness and associate it with figment, even if you haven't really thought about the whole goodness end of it, and you're just kind of thinking about, you know, what thing you're going to point at. That's just error. Okay, but mistaken judgment, the prefix mis means wrong, wrongly taken. Okay, now you've got that whole right-wrong thing in play. Now, you know, the big issue is not the fact or figment. The big issue is, you're wanting to grab a hold of goodness, but have you grabbed a hold of ungoodness in your ignorance? You grab a hold of badness. Have you wrongly taken hold of unity, a relationship to unity? Okay. Wrongly taken, mistaken. Now it doesn't matter if you try to connect it to fact or figment. You're holding on to ungoodness. This is bad. And it's bad. you automatically have error if you evil. If you give that badness form in your mind, error, you can't help but be an error also. Okay. So, it's only true if you have goodness connected to fact. Anything else, there's a problem. It's at least error, and if not, evil also. Okay, so see, all of that, all that's about this whole threefold, notice how you're bringing the threefold actuality, you know, and you need the ability to recognize that objectively, to do that all properly. That's all about the gift from the mother, the three cosmic intuitions. And see, to get this proper wholehearted state in which you have this consecration of will. Yeah. So that's what that is there. It's a little mother footnote in many ways to, you know, the Father's Supreme Rule section. Yeah. All right. What else?
The full appreciation of truth, beauty, and goodness is inherent in the perfection of the divine universe. The inhabitants of the Havona worlds do not require the potential of relative value levels as a choice stimulus. Such perfect beings are able to identify and choose the good in the absence of all contrastive and thought-compelling moral situations. But all such perfect beings are, in moral nature and spiritual status, what they are by virtue of the fact of existence. They have experientially earned advancement only within their inherent status. Mortal man earns even his status as an ascension candidate by his own faith and hope. Everything divine which the human mind grasps and the human soul acquires is an experiential attainment. It is a reality of personal experience and is therefore a unique possession in contrast to the inherent goodness and righteousness of the inerrant personalities of Havona.
See, they have existential goodness, you know, and righteousness. That's not open to us. You know, the goodness and the goodness and righteousness, you know, if you're going to have it, it's experiential acquirement has to be chosen into place. You know, think about, you know, you're constructing a Havona native. You know, in this spiritual part of that Havona native, you construct the spiritual aspect of that being. I mean, they're persons, okay, but you construct that spiritual aspect so that that personality, you know, grabs a hold of it. And it's just, you know, perfect. Just locks right in completely. It's all just right there. You know, they don't have to reform any of that. It's preformed right. And then personality just slips its fingers into it. And then they go from there. You know, you start with almost nothing. Like I said, all you start with is that tiny little bit of grace, that initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit, a little bit of you know, rightness inertia to get the ball rolling. That doesn't get you very far. It gets you basically age 20. And then you need to start choosing. Because you're not a spirit being like the Havona natives. You've got friction. And the friction will grind that spiritual inertia down over time. You have to choose to keep that going. Okay. So, you know, so you've got all these fun little things in here. And that, maybe just one other thing, little thing to notice there. Two things. Let's notice one in passing. By his own faith and hope, the grandeur of trust. See, faith, trust. And then the italicized, it is a reality of personal experience and is therefore a unique possession. You know, that uniqueness of your personality. You know, when you realityize, spirit nature within you, you know, it reflects that uniqueness of your personality. So then again, think about the Havana natives. See, it's not just goodness that's preformed, it's rightness, righteousness. I mean, so they're the substance is made to match their unique personality. You know, you choose to take that substance and make it right and unique, you know, like you, your personality is. All that was pre-done for a Havona native. You know, it's kind of interesting to think about it, that next notch. You know, it's not just goodness, but righteousness that's inherent It's an interesting thing to reflect on, just how different they are. Okay, so, and I think everyone remembers how this ends. And you know, we want to just read it through and let yourself feel the poetry of it. Remember how this is constructed, this last paragraph? It's in parallel to the 9 points. They go through them in order, one at a time, and do the contrastive. Let's just read through it and let all those details that we ground through and going through the bullet points be in play in your mind as you're reading this. Think about all the subtleties and the details, and that's what they're wanting you to have invoked. Okay.
It's also curious, just why 9?
Yeah.
Why 9 points when so often it's 7 or 12 or
I know
something else.
Chris, how about the fruits of the Spirit? Yeah. We have 9 of those, but
there's 11. No, it's a different
9 in the Bible.
Well, yeah, but those are just merely Spirit. Those aren't the cosmic fruits. Andre's question is a good question, and I don't know the answer to that yet. It's probably something that you could figure out though, if you worked at it.
Well, it is curious that the Enneagram, which is part of, human metaphysical lore,
mm-hmm.
Has 9 things. The Jesuits were teaching that, and why the Jesuits are doing that.
Yeah, anyway, the point is, question marks. There's definitely some question marks. I don't claim to have, all this stuff figured out by any means. All right, so they just, let yourself really, really hear these expressions here of the contrast.
The creatures of Havona are naturally brave, but they are not courageous in the human sense. They are innately kind and considerate, but hardly altruistic in the human way. They are expectant of a pleasant future, but not hopeful in the exquisite manner of the trusting mortal of the uncertain evolutionary spheres. They have faith in the stability of the universe, but they are utter strangers to that saving faith whereby mortal man climbs from the status of an animal up to the portals of paradise. They love the truth, but they know nothing of its soul-saving qualities. They are idealists, but they were born that way. They are wholly ignorant of the ecstasy of becoming such by exhilarating choice. They are loyal, but they have never experienced the thrill of wholehearted and intelligent devotion to duty in the face of temptation to default. They are unselfish, but they never gain such levels of experience by the magnificent conquest of a belligerent self. They enjoy pleasure, but they do not comprehend the sweetness of the pleasure escape from the pain potential.
Yeah, and so, you see how, again, they're trying to do like what I said about, those parentheticals. They're trying to bring those parentheticals very definitively into play. See what you have that even perfect beings don't have. What perfect beings go, oh. To only be able to comprehend the sweetness, of the pleasure, okay?
Do you think they envy the ascenders?
And of course, envy is probably a little bit too lowly a word,
No, I think they lecture us constantly.
But that is where, they're wanting you to start thinking, along it's like, wow, I mean, maybe I... maybe I don't envy Havona natives anymore. Maybe I should figure out what this life I've been given is all about instead of regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. Dreaming of being a Havona native. Vainly, that's the vainly hoping for the future. If only, I could, it's not going to happen. Every single Havona native has been created. It's done, period. Before time began. No more are needed. But I want it. No, no more are needed. Okay, so.
So they don't have a self-conquest. They don't build a soul. They don't need anybody.
Which is, you know, another thing that comes into play, you know, when they really put this in front of you like this, it's like, well, what the heck do Havona natives do anyway? You know, what are they? What's their life about? See, that's of course that's the flip for eternity. Yeah, you know, and from eternity, from the eternal past. You know, and, right. What have they been doing? And you know, right. So that's the subtext, of course, of it. But
this only gives us one perspective to paradise. Then there's something beyond.
Right, and of course that's. To understand what lies beyond would be to understand what the heck the Havona natives have been up to and what they're going to be doing. You know, and that's why it's so mysterious, because the second half of our career is so mysterious. It's unfortunate that we can't read the last one, because it's meant to play right off of the poetry of this last paragraph. So remember that for next week. You know, I don't know if you recall how this last section goes, but it's a quite soaring section in many ways.
So, Chris,
yep.
The Havana natives must get enjoyment from watching us ascend. They observe us. And the ones who come through, they come in contact with us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and they're really excited when we get there. Because there are so many things. I mean, the relationship to one of us is something that's, not possible.
It's like the 14th century when the giraffe got to Europe.
and not to but you notice that they threw in a pretty strong word there, the belligerent self. Remember what the word belligerent means. Bellicose means warlike, and belligerent means that bellicosity is innate. Okay, woven into your DNA. Remember when you read about war and that difficult section about war and how it challenges your spiritual consciousness, and the first thing they say is that war is your natural estate. It's called a belligerent self. That's the way you were made. Now, belligerent self isn't some sort of defect in your design. God made you a belligerent self, because that's the whole point. Can you rise up above that belligerent self and become its master?
It's gratitude to do so.
Right. If you can do that, you are adding something to the universe that the Havona natives can't add to the universe. Yeah. So that's actually kind of a core in that whole thing. To face the fact that selves are belligerent by design, and no amount of visionary peace planning or wishful thinking is going to change that. That's the way they were made, very purposely made. That's divine. So you need to, the challenge is extreme.
When you were mentioning that the one paragraph you didn't think seemed to follow along too much with the last two points, what I was thinking was that what is the source and substance of that which makes us suffer and feel pain? And for the most part, It is dealing with the belligerent selves of others and trying to accommodate ourselves in circumstances and trying to adapt. It's the source of disappointment is either not being chosen or not allowing membership in something. I mean, when you get right down to it, it's nice to talk in a sort of an abstract way, but what is the source and substance of that which makes us unhappy? It's other people.
No, it's our thoughts about other people.
Right.
There you go.
It's your belligerent self not being able to deal with other belligerent selves. They should be my servants. And then I would be happy.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. And so when you get to that paragraph that talks about the unity and what it takes to I mean, what we're striving for is to learn how to accommodate ourselves into a companionship or a group of others who we
think are just
really
recognize how that is done. The solution to that tension is not to figure out some way to master others, some totalitarian system to put them in their place and get them in orbit about you. Okay? Your spiritual consciousness loves that idea, by the way. Don't forget that. Your spiritual consciousness goes, ooh, I like that. Okay, self-mastery. It is not your task to master someone else. Your task is to master your belligerent self. I mean, Jesus had peace that passes all understanding, not because he dominated the belligerent selves around him. It's because he dominated his belligerent self. He chose to be happy in the midst of their belligerency. He didn't snap his finger. He could have just snapped his fingers and changed it. Could have changed the genetics just by thinking it. He didn't do that. He mastered himself. If you allow yourself to be offended, you'll never be happy. You have to choose to not be offended. You're not going to somehow make it so there is no offending acts. If you kill all the people, the rocks will rise up against you. Okay? Yeah. Okay? You have to choose to not be offended. And if you start choosing to not be offended, you will move forgiveness up to its proper place of patient love. Yeah? Yeah. So we'll get that soaring ending next time, and we move into a lot more of the details now. You know, we kind of have the big picture in place with this whole God thing, and then they're going to move. You know, they move right into it's like, okay, now you got God. What's that God's relation to the universe and to the individual? And that's where we go next. Let's take a moment.